Now, moving on to the next passage, and this is the core, what we call the pericope, or the main passage on the practice of Satipatthana. So the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, what for here? A monastic meditates by observing an aspect of the body, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. They meditate by observing an aspect of feelings, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. They meditate by observing an aspect of the mind, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. They meditate by observing an aspect of principles, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. So this translation that I've used for this formula is departs from the sort of conventional way of translating this in a number of ways, and it's something that's come out of a lot of sort of consideration over the years about what these things actually mean, and once more just to reiterate that what I'm trying to do here is to express basically what the thing actually means if you were going to actually say that in something resembling idiomatic English. Okay. And so I'll go through and just comment on some of these phrases term by term. Okay, so the Pali, kaya kaya napasti viharati, often translated as he dwells contemplating the body in the body, that would be the Buddhist translation, and most other translators have rendered it something similar. So the Pali phrase, kaya kaya napasti, contemplates a body in the body. So you have this weird idiom, what is a body in the body, right? And they're all of the different commentators and everybody's sort of given their opinion about what this means, and everyone sort of says it means this and it means that and so on. And usually what you typically find is that people will end up saying that what it means is the thing that agrees with how I want to interpret the sutta, and it's saying that. So that's usually the way we arrive at interpretations of things. But in fact, in the suttas themselves, it's made clear in one passage exactly what is meant by this. And so we don't really need to speculate. And that passage is a passage found in the Anapanasati Sutta and also in other places in the suttas where it says, the breath is a certain body among the bodies. Okay? The breath is a certain body among the bodies. So what exactly does that mean? Well, it's a little bit of an obscure phrase, but I think what it means is clear enough. What it means is that the breath is a certain kind of physical phenomena which you experience as one of the whole group of the physical phenomena, right? So you have your body, all of the physical things that you can be aware of, and the breath is one part of that, or one aspect of that. And then it goes on and says, well, one of these feelings is one aspect of that, and so on. So this is what I think the idiom means. When it says a body in the body, what it means is looking at a part of your body or an aspect of your body. Okay? So what it means is that out of all the many different ways that we have of contemplating the body, and we'll see that in the body contemplation, there are many different kinds of meditation you can do within that overall category. So of all of those different ways that you can focus on your body, we're using this one. We're focusing on the breath, or perhaps we're focusing on the 32 parts of the body, or we're focusing on the elements, and so on and so forth. And so all of these are different aspects of the body that we can pay attention to and develop through meditation. So this is what I think that idiom means, and that's why I've translated it in this way. That make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Any questions?
It's just the breath, sorry, nothing more than that, separate to all the other
elements. When you're doing breath meditation, yes.
Okay, that's what you refer to.
Okay. Yeah, so then, of course, you might do another meditation, you're focusing on something else, but at any time you're focusing on a certain aspect of what's happening in your body. Yeah. Okay?
How does something like consider meditation fit? I read through, of course, that there being 14 aspects of the body.
So there's 14 different kinds of meditation on the body mentioned in this particular recension, yeah.
And presumably then anything else isn't worth bothering with because that's not direct practice.
I wouldn't say that. This is just a particular collection of meditations that don't take it in an exclusive sense.
So this, the Christmas casino meditation doesn't really come under this kind of...
Not directly. I mean, you know, but again, it's not meant to be an exhaustive, you know, list of meditations. There's plenty of meditations found in the suttas that are not mentioned here, right? All of the four Brahma Viharas, or as you say, the Kasinas, what they call the six recollections, many things that are found. So this is only a partial list of meditations. So it's an important one, but it's only partial. Kasina meditation is an interesting little sort of byway, if you like, in early Buddhism. It's only mentioned a few times in the early suttas. And kasina meditation is mentioned based on either the elements or on colours. So I think the elements way of doing it is clearly related to the contemplation of the elements in Satipatthana, so that would definitely be part of that. Even though the meditation on colours is not exactly the same, but you can still see that the colours are actually a part of the physical world, right? So you're still actually meditating on some kind of physical reality, some kind of physical experience. So they're not explicitly included under body contemplation, I wouldn't think of them as completely separate. Yeah. Kasina, incidentally, in the suttas, kasina is always interpreted as, understood in the traditions as being an object on which you meditate. So you have like a disc which is blue and you meditate on the blue colour of the disc, but that's not what the kasina means in the suttas. In the suttas, kasina means totality. Okay? And it's a name for a non-dual meditation experience. Okay? So it's not the object on which you do your meditation, it's the name of the experience. Yeah.
I think you might notice this in the Ajahn, just as the Pali Indian, that repetitive body in the body just means body. It's like, it's a naturally redundant sort of idiom in Pali.
Yeah, I think it's more specific than that. Yeah.
Right.
Like I said, it means an aspect, certain aspect of the body.
Where was
the Anapanasati
was the reference you made? Yeah, the Anapanasati Sutta. Where's
that? That's Majjhima Nikaya number 118, is it? 118, yeah. Okay, very good. So they meditate by observing an aspect of feeling. So then I've put the word meditating there. Now in the Pali you have viharati, and Bhikkhubodhi usually translates that as dwells. And the word viharati related to the word vihara, which means a dwelling. Later on became a monastic dwelling or a monastery. And of course in India today you have the state of Bihar. Right, so the whole state has become the vihara, because there were so many monasteries in it that they just decided to call the whole state the vihara or the vihara. But the basic meaning of the word viharati is simply to dwell or to abide or to stay in something. Okay, so it's the same word, for example, which says in the first line where it says the Buddha was staying in the Kuru country. Right, it says Kurusu viharati. Okay, he was dwelling in the Kuru country. Now, the word viharati is used in a number of different ways. It's actually what's called, I think the grammatical world is a periphrastic verb, is that right? Don't quote me on that. It's an adjunctive verb which indicates a duration, okay? So it indicates that there's a sort of a staying in a particular thing. So Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation to dwell is quite fine. I don't really have any problem with it. But often the word viharati and its derivatives specifically means to meditate. For example, you have like the nine anupubha vihara, the nine gradual dwellings, literally, which means nine gradual states of meditation, and so on. And so you actually have this idiom which is used quite commonly in the Pali, and I think Bhikkhu Bodhi even translates it in those cases, like these nine dwellings in meditation or something like that. So he's always trying to be consistent in his renderings. So here I just try to translate it, even though dwelling is fine, but I just try to translate it more directly as to meditate. That's what it's talking about. That's what normally we don't say, I'm going to go and dwell observing the body or something. It's just, you know, it's not incorrect, but it's just not a very natural idiom. You say you're going to go and meditate on the body. Right? That's the word we use, so that's why I use that here. And we already mentioned yesterday about the word anupassana, observation. So the word anupassana literally means to keep on watching something. It's a sustained observation. So meditates by observing an aspect of the body. Kaya kaya anupassi viharati. Any questions on that before we go on? Okay, so then after that basic phrase, you then have like an addendum to each one of the kinds of mindfulness meditation. Ātāpi sampajāno satimā vinaya loke avijja domanasaṁ. Ardent, aware, and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. So I'll just comment a little bit on each one of these. The word ardent, I've tried to find a substitute for that, but I haven't found any that really work better. But ardent means, ātāpi means to, basically means energetic, putting forth energy, right? So practicing diligently. Word ardent, the reason why ardent works well is because they're both related to the idea of fire. Ātāpi in Pali is related to words of fire or heat. But I don't know, ardent always strikes me as a little bit archaic. I don't know if there's a better word, maybe just energetic might be even better. What do you think? You think so? It does, yeah. Sorry?
I quite like
it. It could do. Yeah. Sorry?
Avid.
Avid. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, avid. Yeah, avid for, you know.
That's also
a little bit, yeah. Avid. You're an avid fan. Yeah, that's another one you can use. Yeah, obsessive, yeah.
I think
feverishly obsessed. Active, yeah? Active. Proactive.
Because
In
the secular one, they use active as opposed to passive.
Ah, okay, yeah. Which actually is a distinction that you do find in the suttas. There's a very interesting sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya which talks about those two different ways of doing mindfulness, so directed and undirected. Yeah, so that's interesting. Any other thoughts? Sorry? That's also quite possible, yeah, when need be. The problem with that, the only problem is that you tend to you can sort of get tripped up when you then have to do it in different contexts. That's the only thing. If you're using a phrase, it tends to be a bit less flexible when you're applying it in different contexts. That's the only thing. Yeah. Okay. I mean, just to come back to what we're trying to get at, what we're meaning here with energetic, right? So here we're practicing, right? Now we've all come here to do some meditation, and in a sense, you know, we're all being energetic here on our retreat, right? I mean, this is what energy in Buddhism means, and later on in the sutra it talks about the four right efforts, but what it means is that you actually making an effort to overcome what's unwholesome to do what's wholesome. So even the fact that you're here on the retreat means that you're making an effort, Okay? It actually means that you're making a lot of effort, right? You're making much more effort than pretty much everybody else is at the moment, okay? So there's not much, in the whole of Sydney, there are not many people who are putting more effort than you guys are, right? Okay? So maybe, that's right, right? And, you know, maybe like the guys doing it hardcore out at Jason's Tent Village, there might be a little bit more effort going on there. We'll wait and hear the stories from the people who come back and the survivors. And they, realistically, so we maybe think, oh, you know, I should have meditated longer this morning, or, you know, I was sleepy when I was meditating or something like that. We can sort of get down on ourselves because we feel we're not trying hard enough. But actually, you're trying, you're already making that strong effort just to be here, yeah? At the same time, though, I remember reading in Cave in the Snow when Tenzin Palmo was talking about her time where she was practicing in that cave for so many years, right? All she's doing is meditating all day, every day, right? And I saw Tenzin Palmo just last week, actually, in Sakyadita, so she's in good form still. And interestingly enough, just kind of side note, is that many of you, if you've been hanging around the Buddhist scene for many years, or for the last few years, you probably would know our good friend Aya Yeshe, who's been, as long as I've known her, has been complaining about the fact that nobody's been supporting the Tibetan Sangha in Buddhism. And so Tenzin Palmo now has just taken up that same refrain and actually gave a paper on that in the at Sakyadita conference, and then are setting up an international organization to help to support the Sangha, especially in the Tibetan tradition, the kind of non-traditional Sangha, because in many cases they have to sort of go to work and do jobs and things like that, so they drive a taxi in the daytime and go and run the Dhamma center. She told a story of one nun who'd been working at a Dhamma center for 25 years, running the place, cleaning it, organizing all of the events and so on and so forth, and then she became too old and sick to work anymore, so they told her she had to leave. Oh yes, it happens. So that's pretty bad, isn't it? Huh? That's compassion in action. So it's good to see that Tenzin Palmo's going to be putting her energies, her not inconsiderable energies, behind helping out. Anyway, so come back to that. One of the things that she said about her practice during that time in the cave was that if she had to look back and see what was one thing that she regretted, was that she felt that she could have tried harder. Right? So that's something to think about as well, isn't it? Right? So there's this kind of spectrum about, you know, what is energy and what is effort and how much are we doing and so on. And then there's this spectrum of how much is too much and how much are we pushing and how do we find that right energy, okay? And so right energy in Buddhism is always the energy which is natural and which flows, right? Not the energy which is forced, right? But sometimes you sort of need to sort of bounce around between the extremes a little bit before you find what the middle way is, yeah? And, you know, I think probably most of us have been through that in our practice, and our tendency, of course, I guess the default tendency of most people is just to be lazy, to not really care, not really try. And we come to the spiritual practice, sometimes we tend to go to the opposite extreme, and we maybe, you know, we think, oh, I'm going to go on this retreat and I'm just going to meditate, I'm just going to bash my head against the wall until I get in line. And I mean that literally. First retreat I did, somebody was actually bashing their head against the wall to keep themselves laying. So we want to put forth that effort. But then after a while, we also realize that pushing too hard is not actually getting us anywhere, right? That it's just another kind of, it can come from ego, it can come from like a sort of self-loathing or self-hatred, lack of acceptance. It can come from a restlessness and an impatience and so on. And so we go through different phases where we can be trying too hard and then coming back and so on and so forth. And, even the great meditators will do this. And I remember one of the talks by Ajahn Mahabua, he talks about this. And in the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Mahabhu was kind of renowned. He was like the tiger of the forest tradition. He was a kickboxer before he ordained, and he didn't really change his personality all that much after he ordained. And he had this very, you know, very kind of ferocious temperament, and he was practicing with Ajahn Mun in the early days of the forest tradition, and he used to just be meditating so much, and he would be doing a lot of investigation of the body and staying up all night and doing all of these practices. And when Ajahn Mun saw him doing that, he said, "Buddha, what are you doing?" He said, "Get some sleep. You're going to kill yourself before you get anywhere. You need to find peace of mind." Yeah. And so he then sort of learned to sort of calm his mind down and find a more balanced approach to practice. So it's not, the point I'm trying to make here is that even though we know we're aiming for that kind of middle way where energy flows in our practice, but we also will experiment along the way, and it's okay to sort of, you know, be a bit off sometimes, and sometimes you sleep too much, and sometimes you're pushing too hard, and, you know, you need to kind of explore those different things and see what they feel like so that you understand what that middle way is like. So sometimes when I was in Wat Manachat, we would have a practice where you would stay out meditating all night, once a week. And that's a very difficult practice. That's one of the hardest practices that I had to do. And you reach that time where you it's like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, and your mind goes to some very, very dark places, you know. And you're having to try to keep yourself awake and really having to push to get through the night. It's interesting. You learn something. It's not something that I want to, you know, keep on doing all of the time. But I'm glad I had the chance to be able to do that and to experience what it's like. Because it's very beautiful when the morning comes and your mind kind of lifts and you're like, wow, I haven't slept at all and I'm actually feeling okay. But before that, I used to leave the morning chanting. And you get to like 4 o'clock or something like that, and everyone's been up all night and doing the morning chanting, and you're doing it, and it's especially, it's like all of the old women from the village are there doing the chanting. And by that time in the morning, their voices are getting like really slow and really gravelly and stuff like that. And they've been doing this forever, right? So even though I'm sort of technically leading the chanting, in fact, you know, I just have to do it at their pace, and someone say like, and instead of going and sometimes just kind of blacking out and falling asleep during the chanting, like, where were we? Some monks were known, I never did this, but some monks were known they were so tired when they were doing the chanting, like you do the kind of the bowing and then you wouldn't make it back up again. Just go down. So is that middle way? Not really, right? But it's, you know, you're finding things out, you're learning things. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but you just want to do it with some understanding, don't do it compulsively. So when we're here on retreat time, you know, it's a time to experiment and to try it. If you feel like, okay, tonight I want to stay up all night and meditate, that's all right. You know, or maybe you just, you know, want to, you know, push yourself, or you know, to say, okay, I'm going to do walking meditation all afternoon, or something like that, and just try it out and experiment. Try a few different things. It's okay. And if that means that you've been, you know, you meditate all night and then you feel sleepy in the morning and you need to sleep in, then that's okay as well. Don't worry about it. So just, you know, while you're here, you take that chance to experiment, and who knows what you might learn. But just always keep in mind that the point that we're aiming for, ultimately, is that point of balance. And that right effort is not about doing things that are very extreme. It's about finding the place where energy flows. And when the hindrances are quiet in your mind, then energy will naturally will flow very easily. Just to skip ahead in the sutta, because what's mentioned here briefly under Atapi actually is really the same as that factor of right effort in the Eightfold Path, which is right towards the end on the page number, so the second last page, one, two, three, four pages before the end, section 4.5.4, Noble Truth of the Path, at the bottom of the page there, as a classic sort of definition of right effort. Here, a monastic generates enthusiasm, channam janeti, tries, vayamati, makes an effort, viryam arabati, exerts the mind, chittam paganhati, and strives, padahati, so that bad, unskillful qualities that have not arisen do not arise. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive, so that bad, unskillful qualities that have arisen are abandoned. They generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive, so that skillful qualities that have not arisen do arise, and they generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive, so that skillful qualities that have arisen remain, are not lost, but increase, mature, and are perfected by development. This is called right effort. Okay, so these are the four right efforts. Right? The effort to prevent unwholesome dhammas, to abandon unwholesome dhammas that have arisen, to give rise to wholesome dhammas or skillful dhammas that have not arisen, and to perfect and develop skillful dhammas that are already there. So these are the four kinds of right effort. And so notice that in all of those four kinds of right effort, right, there's nothing extreme, right? There's nothing impossible. This is the thing that's lovely about that, right? When you look at that, you realize all of those things are things that you have done. Okay? You've all seen the opportunity, seen something, maybe something unwholesome or bad is going to come up, so I'll turn my mind a different way or something. You've all seen something bad in your mind and been able to let go of it. You've all been able to give rise to some good dhammas, and you've all been able to develop those good dhammas. Right? These are ordinary things that not just you guys, but actually everyone has always done at some point in time. Right? And so what we're doing is we're becoming conscious of these, and we're realizing that this is where the practice lies. Okay, and so right effort isn't, being in the meditation hall at the right time. Okay, it's not, the ability to walk meditation for hours on end. I mean, these are things which you can use, which are practices to develop right effort. But that's not what the effort is itself. The right effort itself is to recognize what's those skillful and unskillful qualities, abandon the unskillful and develop the skillful. Okay. Right, yeah. Channam janeti, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that requirement, or is that something a little bit more slippery that can arise from the world?
Enthusiasm.
Generating enthusiasm is a bit effort, strive for that.
It is, yeah. Well, it can be, but this is the point. This is talking about that aspect in practice where you can, deliberately do these things. The Pali is very clear. Janeti means to make arise the chanda, yeah, to generate it. And that's right. And so what it means is that when you think about, to think about Dhamma practice and all the good things you can be doing, to think about them in a positive way, remind yourself what are the benefits of those things, remind yourself, remember the last time you were on retreat and you had a really nice meditation experience, it'd be lovely to, find that peace again and so on and so forth. And so there's ways that you can reflect to sort of give rise to that enthusiasm. Yeah.
What about
perseverance? Perseverance actually is a good word, yeah. So that's actually one of the renderings that we could use for that. The last word there, perhaps exert the mind and strive, perhaps exert the mind and persevere might be good, might be even better. I'll think about that. Yeah, perseverance is good because perseverance, the idea of not stopping. Yeah, it's very important. Mm.
remembering.
Sorry?
Remembering is important too, isn't it? Like what you said before, remembering when you had good meditation.
Right.
But keeping that in mind helps with perseverance.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just right with perseverance.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Well, personally, you know, it's a story I've told many times, but this is where the idea of energy from the Lord of the Rings. I don't know if you heard me. You probably heard me know this one, or maybe not. Anyway, in the Lord of the Rings, when Frodo and Sam are on the way to Mount Doom, and they have a conversation, which is actually kind of the core of the whole book in many ways, but they have a conversation about what it means to be a hero. Actually, one of the words for energy in Pali is virya, which is literally is heroism. The literal translation is from the noun vira, meaning hero. And so they have this idea, and Sam says, oh, I wonder if they'll sing songs about us. Yeah? And they sing songs about the heroes. And he says, well, basically they say, well, only if we make it. Right? They don't sing songs about the ones who turn back, yeah? The ones who give up. And really, that's all that makes a hero, is that they just don't stop. And no matter what happens, you keep going. Okay, so... So what is it that makes you enthusiastic?
Interest,
yeah.
Desire.
Yeah. Happiness, yeah.
Faith.
Yeah, so these are all like positive emotions, yeah, that draw you into it. Interesting, nobody said any intellectual things, right? I become enthusiasm because I became convinced that dependent origination was an accurate description of the mind-body process. Therefore, I wanted to go and meditate, right? Yeah? Interesting, yeah? And that's actually very true. You know, there's a difference between like an understanding of things and a theoretical understanding and what actually moves you, yeah? And so what moves us is that emotional connection, right? And that feeling like there's some, it makes a difference, right? It makes a difference in yourself. And if you can actually see that, then that's going to motivate you to practice. So that, again, that's something to just be aware of, not to hold on to too tightly, but just to be aware of when we're practicing, to appreciate those moments of peace, right? To appreciate the happiness, yeah? To, you know, when you finish the meditation at the end of the day, or, you know, just in the evening, you can wander around and you look and you think, oh, I actually feel peaceful now. This is what peace of mind is. And you remind yourself, actually, it's possible. Peace of mind is not something which is, it's not an abstract idea. It's not just something which is just found in books. It's a reality. And it's a reality that we can experience through our practice. Anything else? Anybody else have any tips? What makes them enthusiastic? What brings up energy?
Results.
Results?
You're doing something, and I know I don't get enthusiastic if I'm not, I don't feel like I'm getting any of it. If you experience a little bit like a result,
right,
I'm enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. I mean, classically they say that one of the best ways of developing energy is through the death contemplations, right? Which we'll be talking more about later, but of course we have our cemetery next door, right? And so, just remind yourself, yeah, I haven't got long. Yeah, the urgency of things, yeah, impermanence. So a bit of wholesome fear helps now and then.
But sometimes when you're not getting results, and you have to get some enthusiasm, and you're not getting, that's the hardest time, you have to be thinking, hopefully, that, or getting the intention that, oh, I can get a benefit, somewhere else where I've been at fixed mind. It's sort of hopeful that the fear will come.
Sure, yeah.
Or actually just curiosity. Why am I like that? And curiosity and movement forward helps enthusiasm. It's not judging what's happened, isn't it? Didn't then think, oh, we're having a block, or that's a problem, or we're going backwards. But it's all part of the whole thing.
Right, and that's another one of the sort of classical ways of increasing your energy is to recollect the Buddha as a very great example of someone who had a lot of energy, but also to associate with people who are energetic and who are practicing or who are putting forth energy, and it's kind of catching. This is one of the reasons why it's nice to be on retreat from time to time and to be with other people who are practicing. And then that gives you some inspiration to put forth a little bit more effort.
Suffering?
Mm-hmm. Suffering makes you energetic?
Well, you look for ways of doing things, so you have to strike.
Yeah. Suffering is really interesting. Sutta of the Buddha says suffering has two outcomes. One is despair, and the other is a search. Yeah? So it depends how you respond to it. Sometimes you just get ground down by the suffering, and you think, oh, I'll take some pills and crawl into bed, and maybe it'll all be gone away in the morning. Yeah? But otherwise you say, okay, let's do something about it. Huh? Let's look. I think if we didn't have some suffering, none of us would be here. This is something that you learn, as a Buddhist teacher. Sometimes you're talking to people and they're just too happy and content. And you think, I'm not going to bother, Wait until they've suffered a bit and they'll be back. Sorry, I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Yeah. Red, so there's two sides to it.
Uh-huh.
One comes with the discussion, suffering discussion.
Yeah.
It's certainly not one way I deal with the understanding of wisdom operation.
Sorry?
It's certainly not one way of understanding you suffering unnecessarily is the primary motivation.
Uh-huh, yeah.
I think all the words suffering personally,
it just seems
to be a problematic position. Mm-hmm. So I think you should do something different.
Yeah.
I think that's my primary motivation.
Right.
So thank you so much.
Yeah.
Doesn't studying the Dharma, sorry.
Yeah? Go on.
Studying the Dharma generates enthusiasm, I think. Especially the moral codes like the Paramita and the
Seven practices awakening, avoiding hindrances. Yeah. Yeah. Connection to
why I'm on path.
Right.
I've got something to aim for.
Right. Yeah. And it always seems to me, these things are just such beautiful teachings, and they make so much sense, and you can see all of these different dhammas that come from all these different perspectives and so on. And each of them has like its own kind of shape, and everything kind of fits together really kind of nicely. And it's very, 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 there actually is something meaningful to this, there's something real to it.
It works.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another big call is that somehow I'm not looking too far ahead. So, for example, struggling to get good concentration, walk, meditation, and so just say, all I really do is aim to be present until I get to the end of the track, that's it, and then take the next bit, take the count. So it makes it more.
The end of the track is too far.
Well,
it's just the next step. Yeah.
We could work with any effort anyway.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point, yeah.
Okay. become more interesting and then you become more enthusiastic because of the interest.
Yeah.
Is there any major drawback to using archaic English? Is it the most appropriate to the word? But I really like artists.
Yeah, it depends. There's actually quite a lot of archaic words which work better than modern words for various kinds of things in Buddhism, right? So, for example, the best translation of suffering, of dukkha, sorry, is ill. The archaic meaning of ill is perfect for dukkha, yeah? But of course you can't do that. Yeah. What are some other ones which are really good?
What was the archaic meaning of ill?
Basically dukkha. Yeah, it means that there's a wrongness to the world. There's things which are, it's the opposite of well. Yeah, so it's not specifically, you know, physical or medical illness. Yeah. Well, another good one is norm for Dhamma. Norm is a terrific translation of Dhamma, right? Of course, if you've grown up in Australia in the 1980s and the life beginner, right, then it's gone forever, right? That was, you can never use it again. You know, some archaic words you can't use anymore. I remember one of Yanomoli's translations, he described the devas celebrating when the Buddha was born. And so when the Buddha was born, the devas were celebrating extravagantly gay. So yeah, sometimes you have to, yeah, you can't quite use that one anymore. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make a translation which will speak to people whose are learning English as a second language, right? People not from a maybe not university educated and so on and so forth. So simple English. The majority of people who speak English today speak it as a second language. Right? And within, I think, a fairly short time, I think maybe 10 years or something like that, there'll be more English speakers in China than there are in America. Yeah? One of the things that I've found, you know, so for myself, you know, I grew up devouring books, right? As soon as I found, you know, libraries and stuff like that, we would just read and read and read hundreds and hundreds of books, you know. And then when I was at uni, when we were reading Dostoevsky and James Joyce and all of these kinds of things, and so for me, you know, I can read something like Picabodes or whatever, and it's just normal, I don't even notice it. Huh? But one of the things that I've learned through spending a lot of time in Asia and Thailand and Malaysia and things like that is that even people whose conversational English might be quite fine, right? You can talk to them and their English is quite okay, but it makes it a lot harder to read things that have those kinds of archaic or unusual words in them. And so it just makes that much more of an obstacle to reading it than it needs to be. So yeah, I mean, in some cases, I think it's okay. You know, if it's clearly the best choice, then sure, you have to do it. And, you know, it's not a bad thing when you're reading to learn new words, right? It's a good thing to do, actually. In fact, and that's part of the joy of reading, is also to learn new words. But it just has to be in balance, you know? If it's too much, then it becomes a real obstacle. Yeah, so
then you're diluting and forgetting the heritage and the richness
of the language.
Yeah. Shying away from using archaic words, goodbye.
But you have lots of really fun new words, yeah?
Maybe.
So, you know, I can put lol and the monk said to the Buddha, OMG, that was my first example. That's the kind of thing that I'm thinking of doing, yeah. Eager. Oh, that's interesting, right? Yeah, eager.
I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
weeks.
Yeah.
Virtually every device has a dictionary built into it these days. It's people are reading it on them.
So which, sorry, what?
I say every device these days has a dictionary.
A built-in dictionary, yeah. Yes, yeah, so you can look stuff up, yeah. So
also, has a connotation of intensity about it.
Right.
That often other words don't have.
Right, and Ātāpi, the Pali word Ātāpi, does have that intensity to it. It's related to the word tapas, which is to the ascetic practices, and is also kind of which itself is related to things like the burning of the sun, and the idea in the pre-Buddhist traditions that when you practice, you would actually sort of generate a heat inside yourself, which would like burn off your defilements and your suffering. So this is, I mean, obviously it's adapted in the Buddhist tradition, but that's like where it's coming from, right? So it certainly has that flavour to it, yeah.
And you can't teach it to aversions for very,
you know, like teenagers and fellow adults. Uh-huh, uh-huh. Problem with that is you have to update it every few years, yeah. Every few months, yeah, you know. You know, and one I can say, you know, the Devas were, when they heard about the Buddha's, you know, birth, they were happily twerking. Then by next year, that won't be a thing anymore. One of the things, just to give you a bit of background of what we're doing with the translation project, is that we're developing a software which is a what it essentially does is that we split the text up into segments, which are usually like a sentence or something like that, and then we translate it sentence by sentence. So what that means is that at the end of the day, you can always see what's the Pali behind this particular sentence, and then we'll have the various dictionary tools and things like that to look up the exact words there as well. So this is, and those tools will then be available in the multiple languages as well. So we'll start out with an English language translation, and then we'll go to doing various other world languages, and each one of those you'll be able to do the same thing. So this is the idea, is that you know, for you translate it, you know, for the 90 or 95% of people who are just going to want to read the translation, but for those who want to look more deeply and look see what's the Pali term behind that, then you make that possible for them as well. Ken. You write it, we'll deploy it, man. You write it. Yeah, you can. I mean, the whole translation will be open source and freely available, so anybody can adapt it any way they want. So, and I think that's a good thing. I think that... I think that if you look in the sphere of Bible studies, it's one of the things I've been keeping an eye on, right? I mean, there's a couple of hundred translations of the Bible, in English, right? There's more than, I think, 1,500 translations in the different languages. And they have, like, the Lolcats Bible, for example. Sorry? The Lolcats Bible, yeah. The whole Bible is written in using Lolcats memes. Yeah. Anyway, we're not going to do that with the sisters. But, you know, they have... Yeah, something like that.
Mm.
So, but the thing is that you then target that very specifically. You have like the King James Bible, which is the one people have grown up with. You can have simple English Bibles. You can have very literal ones. You can have very scholarly ones, and so on and so forth. And they'll even do ones where they will change the spelling and idioms from English to American English. Right, so it'll be the same translation, but not just the spelling conventions, but a few different kind of idioms and phrases and so on. I'll go through very carefully and adapt that for the different markets and things like that. So, you know, that's something which I think, you know, there's no reason why that we couldn't be doing the same thing with the suttas. And once we have a fully open source and consistent version, it won't be too hard to make those kinds of adaptations.
Yeah.
You can get your app version. You can. Yeah.
Alright. I'd like
that
for school.
Okay. Which one would you like for school?
The rap.
The rap one?
Roy's trying to find songs that they can like to.
Yeah.
Especially the Western
piece. Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, there's not many good Buddhist songs around.
There are two in Monday. Buddhist songs.
There are, yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember Indonesia, so. During my time in uni, we actually have a competition for people who write Buddhist songs.
Yeah.
And we produce CD and cassettes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talking about archaic,
yeah.
Right, I mean, that's actually a good point. In Buddhism, especially Indonesia, and also Malaysia and Singapore, they do have quite an active culture of writing and performing Buddhist songs. So maybe if you're interested to use some stuff for the kids there, that would be, you know, get in touch with some of the groups and you know, see what they've got. Yeah, that's a good idea. There you go, there's a contact. You can follow that up.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah,
I'm
not
sure, yeah.
Not sure if people make it work.
Okay. So we've got the aunt out of the way. Mata pi. And Mata pi. Sampajana. Aware. Next one. Aware. Sampajana. And so this phrase I've translated just as aware. Pali word is sampajana. And it's from the root jhana, meaning to know or be aware of. Particularly what this particular phrase means is something like contextual awareness. We'll talk more about sampajanya when we're looking later at the section on the, there's a whole section on this, the awareness section, and we'll talk more about the quality of sampajanya when we come to that particular section, because that will, I think, make it a lot more clear. But essentially what it means is being aware, and especially being aware of your context. So I'm aware and mindful, just repeating the inclusion of mindfulness there, and rid of desire and aversion for the world is the last one, and this requires a little bit of explanation. The Pali is vinaya loke avijjha domanasa, having put aside covetousness and grief for the world, is, I think, Nyanamoli's translation. I think the Kabodhi's rendering has evolved a little bit over the years. So the Pali is vinaya, which means there's somewhat of an interpretive problem here, which I'll get to in just a minute, but the Pali word is vinaya, which means literally means having dispelled or having got rid of, something like that. Vinaya loke, regarding the world, okay? We locate in the world or regarding the world. And again, that's a phrase which whose significance is perhaps not as obvious as you might think. But anyway, locate abhijja nomanasan, and then abhijja meaning, abhijja is one in the ten ways of skillful action, the dasa kusala kama pata. Abhijja is defined specifically as being strong desire to own the possessions of others. Okay? So wishing, oh, may somebody else's possessions be mine, right? And so that literally means covetousness. Okay, that's exactly what it means in that particular context. And it's often been translated in the same way here. It's not entirely clear that it actually means covetousness in this particular case. But that's why it's often translated as covetousness. And the last word is dominasa. Dominasa in Pali usually means mental sadness. Okay, so it means a mental unpleasant feeling, and we translate it as sadness. Okay, but sometimes also dominasa can mean aversion, right? Dislike of things. Right? So it's not just sadness, but it's not wanting, you know, so it's like a synonym for ill will or for anger. Okay? So the question arises, is exactly what's the implication of this particular phrase, right? Because one way of reading it would be to say that before you begin doing your satipatthana meditation, you already have to have got rid of desire and aversion for the world, okay? So let's give up and go home, right? Being the obvious conclusion, okay? We'll get rid of the desire and aversion first, somehow, and then we'll begin our meditation, right? So that's one possible reading of it. The abhijja dominasa are similar or the same as the first two of the five hindrances, right? So the five hindrances are desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. And so those first two, so it's almost like you have to have got rid of all the five hindrances before you're even doing satipatthana, which seems, well, a bit of a high standard anyway. And some people have tried to get around that by saying that vinaya doesn't mean having got rid of, but because of a sort of grammatical sleight of hand, it can also mean getting rid of or in the process of getting rid of. I don't find that convincing. But Venerable Brahmali actually did a paper on this a number of years ago, and he pointed something out which I think makes a lot of sense and which I think explains what this thing means. And the point that he made was that what this is referring to is the practice of sense restraint. Okay? And the practice of sense restraint is referred to in a standard passage which is found very, very often in the suttas, not found here. Can I find it quickly? That's not bother. Okay. But is one of the preparation practices leading up to meditation. Right? Now, I mentioned yesterday that the practice of being mindful in your different postures is one of those preparation practices. Okay? So I'll give you a bit more context for that now. We know about the basic framework in Buddhism. We have Sila, Samadhi, Panya, right? Ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Right? Now, that's explained in detail in a teaching called the gradual training. Okay? The gradual training found many, many times through all of the Nikayas and the Vinaya and the Abhidhamma. It's one of the most standard passages and standard teachings on practice. And the gradual training begins by hearing the Dhamma, going forth, undertaking the precepts and the silas. Okay? Then it has a section on all of these preparation practices, okay? And then undertaking meditation, developing jhanas and becoming enlightened and so on. And so this, in the middle, you have this series of practices which are all there in between, if you like, keeping precepts, which is your basic practice, and then starting meditation. You have a bunch of things to focus on. And they vary from place to place. There's no kind of master list of these, but typically they include things like contentment, okay? And so it has a very lovely phrase that wherever a bhikkhu goes, he goes just like a bird only takes his wings with him wherever he goes. In the same way, a bhikkhu, when he goes, just takes his bowl, his robes, and his laptop with him. That's how I was thinking of translating it. Anyway. When a bhikkhu goes, he just goes with his roll and robes, his laptop, his tablet, his mobile, his Kindle. Okay, so contentment, moderation in eating, right? So not eating too much or too little. Moderation in sleeping, right? Not sleeping too much or too little. As I mentioned before, the practice of mindfulness in your daily life, the awareness, clear comprehension, another one. And just trying to think if there are any others. Anyway, there's different ones mentioned in different places, but one of them is the practice of sense restraint, okay? And this is one of those preparation practices leading up to meditation. And sense restraint is always described as being you guard your eye, right? So your visual sense, you guard your visual sense so that bad or unskillful dhammas that might overwhelm you don't overwhelm you by the way of the eye, right? And so in that phrase, it always uses this idea of it has the word loke in there, and it has the idea of the avijja dominasa as well, the desire and aversion, right? So it uses very similar language to what we're finding here. And there's a bunch of connections in terms of the linguistic connections, which I won't go into all of the details, but suffice to say that once you actually look at those two passages in the Pali, you realize that actually it's talking about the same thing. So what that means is that in the context of Satipatthana, that when we're developing the meditation, that what we neya loke vijja dominasa means is that we have restrained or kept in check those strong emotions of either desire or aversion, okay, which tend to sweep us over and get us overwhelmed or obsessed with regard to worldly things, okay. So it might be sexual desire for food, and all of these kinds of things, and it might also be different kinds of hatred and anger and so on and so forth. And so if we're going about and we allowing ourselves to get very angry about things or get very caught up in things and so on, and then when we come to meditate, the meditation is not going to be very successful. Right? So the practice of sense restraint is something which is, of course, very strongly supported when we're here on retreat. Right? That's why we come here to a nice quiet place. There's nothing too exciting around here. Right? It's, some nice trees and things like that, and these are fairly calming, but we don't have like the whole kind of very stimulating environment, right? And so this is, this is the whole design of like shopping centres and so on is designed explicitly to destroy your sense restraint, right? That's what the whole thing is there for, no other reason than to make you lose your mindfulness, right? And so you're familiar with the idea of the Gruen transfer that they named the television program after. That's the Gruen transfer being the moment that you walk into a shopping center and you forget what you came there to buy. Okay? And you're so bedazzled by all the shiny surfaces and all of the different things and distractions that you've now completely forgotten. And that's the aim of designing shopping centers is to reduce that period as much as possible. Okay, so to get you to lose your mindfulness, as soon as you walk through the door, as quickly as possible. So this is what all of those things are for, and that's what sense restraint, the opposite of that. So we surround ourselves with things that are kind of boring to look at, nothing hugely exciting, and it's just peaceful and it's calming, and so it gives us that support so that when we come to sit in meditation, that those strong, sort of sweeping of the mind away through desire and aversion, that's been held in check. And we're ready to begin the meditation.
Yeah. If you take the prior interpretation that it seems to be a practice done like post-samadhi, is that why the passing schools have been co-opted this sutra?
I think that I don't think it's why they've co-opted it. I think that's sort of congruent with that way of looking at it. But I think the reason why they've adopted it is because of the sort of strong emphasis on the origination and dissolution and so on and so forth. Yeah. And because it doesn't, because in the shorter version anyway, it doesn't explicitly mention jhanas, so it's one of the only major meditation suttas. I mean, you've got so many meditation suttas that talk about jhanas. And so you sort of pick up one of the only ones that doesn't and say, so you don't need jhanas. Yeah.
What's the difference between aware and mindful?
You can tell me whether you think the translation captures this, but the difference between the meaning, as we talked yesterday about mindfulness as having the meaning of continuity, right? So it basically means that you keep on remembering, you keep on being aware of what it is that you're doing, okay? And sampajanya, what it means is something like contextual understanding or contextual awareness, okay? So, again, this is a story I've told many times, so forgive me if you've heard this story before, but I learned the difference for this after my first retreat when I was in Thailand. And I finished, we did like a 1 month intensive Mahasi retreat, meditating 14 hours a day until the end of the retreat. You meditate for 4 days without sleeping. And all very, very, you know, just so movements. I said this is why some of the people were bashing their heads against the wall. And some of them, as long as you do it mindfully. Anyway. And I had a great retreat. I really enjoyed it and so on. And then after the retreat finished, I was like, okay, I'm going to keep my mindfulness going. I'm going to keep my practice going. And after 1 or 2 days after the retreat, just sort of coming down from the retreat, and the people at the monastery asked for help. They had a small job and they asked for a few of the meditators to come and give them a hand. And so, of course, we said yes. And they demolished a little building, a little hut, and they wanted to move the pieces of wood to another place in the monastery. And so, you know, of course, when you're in Thailand, you just, you know, there's no kind of OH&S or anything like that. So you're just wearing these little, you know, thin rubber flip-flops and you sort of, I remember very, very clearly standing on the side of that, the building site, and the kind of demolished timbers and things around, and then thinking, okay, now I've got to be mindful. This is the first thing that I've done since my retreat, okay? First thing, be mindful, right? Let's see, this is going to be your test, right? So I was very mindfully picked my foot up, very mindfully moved it across, very mindfully put it down, and very mindfully trod on the first nail. my very first step. Okay? Straight down onto a nail. Okay? Ah, okay. Yeah, that's mindfulness. Yeah. So that was the end of that, right? So that, you know, that's the difference between mindfulness and sampajanya, right? So in that case, I had mindfulness, right? So I was completely aware of where my foot was, right? But I had no kind of awareness of the context of actually what I'm doing, right? And so you're there on a building site. It's not just about being aware where your foot is, but it's being aware what you're kind of stepping on for a start. And so that's the difference. So sampajanya, in a sense, is like broader, and it has a awareness of your surroundings, awareness of what's going on, awareness of what's the point of what you're doing, right? You know, where am I going to, what, and so on.
Does it have a connotation of knowing as well?
Of course, yeah. 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 Yeah.
So it's like a 360 degree view of the whole situation.
Yes.
A little piece of puzzle in there.
Yes.
And a little piece of puzzle is more like micro-awareness.
Yeah. I wonder what's the best way to express that in English.
Clear comprehension.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it. Clear comprehension is quite good. Clear comprehension? I don't know. It's not particularly, I don't think it's particularly okay.
How does my
I think these days he uses full awareness. Yeah. Rather. Something like that? Yeah? Yeah. I mean, really, I think it means contextual understanding and contextual awareness. Or maybe you can just translate it like that. Sorry, yeah.
Maybe not now, but at some point I'd be interested to hear you speak about the difference between sampajanya and yonisamanasikara.
Uh-huh. So sampajanya, so what we've been talking about, is contextual awareness. Perhaps we can use contextual awareness. Yonisamanasikara, another phrase, very important phrase in Buddhism, and another one that's also very hard to translate, and I'm not sure how to translate it. But the meaning of it is quite straightforward. What it means is something like investigation into or paying attention to the roots of things. Okay, so paying attention to causes. Some often translated as wise attention or careful attention or something like that. Doesn't quite necessarily always capture it. But Yonisamanasikara typically means like an active inquiry into the roots of things, into the causes of things.
Investigation,
yeah.
They both yep. seem to have that cause or act, that understanding,
they do, because Sampajanya is a bit more, Sampajanya is a bit less, if you like, less specialized, more preliminary, more general, right? So it's like a general contextual understanding of what's happening and so on. Yonasa Manasikara tends to be used in more specific contexts, like it's understanding of the Four Noble Truths or investigating the roots of things. So it tends to be a bit more kind of technical and more specifically into understanding Buddhist Dharma truths, whereas Sampajanya is more just about knowing what it is that you're doing at that time. It's not completely different, they're obviously related, but that's just sort of different nuance of them.
So,
yeah.
So Sampajanya, so someone who's never even said a meditation tree has no idea about Buddhism, they are practicing Sampajanya all the time. You can't not practice
mindfulness,
is that right?
How can you not? Well, you can practice, no, like when I trod on the nail, I wasn't practicing something.
Oh, no, sorry, definitely you're always practicing it, but you can't get through life without at least practicing.
Oh, sure.
Practicing, at least, you know,
sometimes.
Time, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But mindfulness, you don't ever have to be mindful at all.
Oh, no, I think, I think all of these are things, everything in Buddhism, all in the past is bhavetabha, right? Bhavetabha means to make more of something. Okay, so it's always things that you have already, and you're making more of it. Mm. Yeah. 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 It'd be difficult. Sometimes it seems that way.
You might have to write some new commentaries because when part of the investigation of others is actually going and understanding what these words mean. And how
that's
to be applied on the path.
Sure, yeah.
As you point out, they're all mental faculties. Right. I don't know the other very well. I don't know they're in that one. Yes,
of course they are, yeah.
But it's the ones that are to be developed. But this, so using these words, if that triggers somebody to go, but they'd have to read commentaries that those would really be finished. Like the story about the nail, most people would get that.
Uh-huh.
That's
going to
save much
time for the next month. Yeah, yeah. There's nice stories in the Sutta about Sampajanya and the meaning of it, actually. Yeah.
Does it have a component of intuition in it?
Maybe.
Sense of experiential, because it's like sometimes I can only attest a label and it's very hard and I can go on describing what the other view. But actually, when somebody bites onto the mango or maybe you know exactly the problem is we can't always tell, it was how we interpret and perception, interpretation goes hand in hand. So however much you write the words, somebody coming from a different background or you know, environment, depending on that increment, it could change. But
of course,
actually,
yeah.
It's the experience and that the group is talking, and once it comes to the meditation, these words become very clear because you have experience and you can't actually pinpoint, but you know how subtle and what is sweet.
Absolutely.
What's
yeah.
joy within you and what's tranquil rather than having to explain.
Yeah.
So you could be writing so many books. The general idea is to get people to do this is a good thing or whatever.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we have to be, you know, there's a limit to how far we can take words. Huh? And so, you know, words are good enough, but yeah, can't push them too far. One of the things we're doing this conference in Perth after we finished this retreat and going back to Perth, and then in a couple of weeks we're doing a conference, and on the panel I'm doing a panel with some very people who are doing very cool stuff, like one of them's growing his own brain in a jar. And then I was talking to some people about this, and they said, growing your brain in a jar, what's that got to do with Buddhism? And I'm like, you don't understand. He's growing his own brain in a jar. Who cares if it's got anything to do with Buddhism? Cool. But one of the people I spoke to, I actually had a long chat with him the other day on Skype, is a fellow called Neil Haverford, who was the kind of the world's sort of first sort of fully recognized cyborg. And he's profoundly colorblind, so he only sees shades of gray. And he had implanted in his skull about 10 years ago an antenna, which he uses for perceiving various kinds of things that we can't perceive. Right? And so he actually sees, and we were talking about this, and he actually sees it as a completely distinct sense. And so it's not like sight or any of the other senses, but he gets various kinds of impressions. And it's kind of been upgraded various times. So now he can do a Wi-Fi link to satellites and like see the cosmic radiation and things like that. And actually, experiences. Sorry?
Which
side of the visible spectrum? The infrared? It's not in the visible spectrum. It's entirely separate sense.
That's what I mean. You've got the electromagnetic spectrum.
He can do both. Yeah. So he can experience. Yeah. Depending on how the antenna works, because it'll be adjusted and so on. But yeah, they can set it to receive infrared or ultraviolet and microwaves or all different kinds of things.
So he can actually pick up visible wavelengths as well.
Does
his interpretation be different to our sense of
colour? Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked to him about this. It's obviously a bit weird, right? Because he's got an antenna stuck into his brain, and. Of course, we don't really know how these things work and how the brain processes these things, right? So essentially what they do is they just stick it in there and let the brain make sense of it, right? So it's not like it's kind of wired up in some sophisticated way to the brain. It's just this stimulus which is right there, and the brain kind of learns how to interpret it, which is also kind of, quite interesting. But yeah, he says, he experiences it as a, maybe like a vibration or as a, but he sees it as a distinctly separate sense.
You said he was more broadly aware and not deeply mindful. Maybe that's a way
to put it. Well, whether he's mindful or not,
it's up there. It's different between aware and mindful as well.
Yeah.
I was on a mindfulness course, there's all this mindful that we did. So I was mindfully putting the shopping in the shopping basket, aware of the weight and feel of the objects. Sorry, but then aware of the fact that the family shop was behind me.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, and that's precisely the thing, that's the difference between mindfulness and sampajanya awareness. Yeah.
That example for now was good too. The awareness kind of the outer and the mindfulness is the inner?
No, it's not, because they both can be outer and inner, right? So sampajanya is also, for example, sampajanya is present in the jhanas as well. So it can be, it's part of your inner experience, but it's more to do with, like I said, a contextual or a more broad understanding or awareness.
So it's broad, deep work.
It's quite good, yeah. Yeah. General awareness. Yeah. Sorry.
Can the cyborg practice better Australian? Can he stop the,
Can he switch it off? I'm not sure whether he picks up stuff from mobile towers and things, but look, I'm sure he can switch it off if he wants to. Yeah.
Jhana,
the same word, no, different word. Yeah, so this is related to jnana. So jnana, panya, sampajanya, sanya, anya, and so on. It's all from the same root. But actually, the root jnana, where jhana is from the root dhyā, or root from, in Sanskrit dhyā or d.
I don't think tools now about meditation and practicing on about just focusing on the process of why do you choose the tools now about meditation? What do you there's different kinds of meditation.
Yeah.
So, you know, why can't everyone focus on either practicing or something?
Why? Because the world would be so boring. What would we talk about? We'd just have to meditate. We wouldn't be able to argue about meditation. there are different approaches to meditation, you know, and different kinds of meditation suit different kinds of people, and it's always been that way. So diversity is good, you know, it's not a problem. And, you know, we shouldn't think meditation is not something which is prepackaged, you know. It's very personal, it's very individual, and you know, there are many different you know, when you even if you've got a bunch of people and you just say to them, do this and meditate this way, you're actually all going to do different things anyway, right? So we all have these different approaches, so it's not, you know, to me that diversity is a good thing, but you know, we just have to sort of engage with it in a healthy way. Don't get too kind of sectarian about it, or too close-minded about what's the right way and what's the wrong way. Yeah, and that's why, you know, from my point of view, you know, if you look at all the different meditations people are doing, I think all those meditations are good. You know, I just think that sometimes people get too dogmatic about them. That's the only problem. But you know, I think all of the different meditations and different approaches have something to offer. Yeah. Okay. So, where are we now? Oh, so, on the second line of the paragraph. Oh, interesting, yeah. Okay. Okay, so, they meditate by observing an aspect of the body, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. They meditate by observing an aspect of feelings, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. So we'll be looking more at the contemplation of feelings later on, but just initially, feelings, probably one of the easier things here to understand, but essentially meaning the pleasant, painful, or neutral tone of things, whether something is likable or unlikable, or whether you don't care about it. So this is what's our feelings. So feelings is not the more complex emotions that we have about things, but it's just that very simple tone that any kind of experience has. Okay? Any questions about that? Yeah?
I'm just curious what, where you got the word aspect.
Mm-hmm.
What word you were translating?
It was just sort of early, this is a repetitive idiom, so a feeling in the feelings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so an aspect of the feelings. Yeah? Something like that, yeah.
An aspect becomes a big topic of discussion, akara.
Ah, yeah, no, it's not meant in any kind of deep or philosophical sense, it's just an ordinary language term, yeah. Akara, yeah. Okay, yep. They meditate by observing an aspect of the mind, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. So the mind here is citta, and here it means the simple awareness, the actual, the mind, the knowing mind. And finally, they meditate by observing an aspect of principles, dhammas, ardent, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. We mentioned this yesterday, in this Dhammanupassana is often translated as being aware of mind objects. Mind objects is always wrong. It never means that in early Buddhism. But it's certainly wrong in this context of Satipatthana, because it talks, if you look at what's included under Dhammanupassana, includes lots of things which are not mind objects at all. For example, it includes the five aggregates and things like that. More specifically, when mind objects is used as a translation of Dhamma in the context of the six kinds of consciousness, so you have the mind, the mano, the Dhamma, mind translated as mind objects, and so on, and that's I think, a bad translation and quite mistaken, in fact, for a number of reasons. One reason being that there's no such idea in Buddhism of things having an objective reality, right? There's no objects which exist outside of your consciousness, right? Everything exists always in relation to your consciousness, okay? So Buddhism is neither a realist nor a, what's the opposite of realist? Idealist, thank you. Yeah, it's neither realist nor an idealist philosophy, right? So idealist philosophy is the idea that everything only exists in your mind. Realist philosophy is the idea that things exist independently and objectively out there in the real world, okay? So Buddhism is a philosophy of relation and says that the world that we experience is a relationship between the inner and the outer, okay? And so once we talk about in terms of mind objects, then you start to talk about things that exist somehow independently of your mind, and that's very misleading. It's also misleading because if we are to use the word object of mind in English, what it means is that thing in your mind to which you are paying attention. Okay? So maybe you're having a thought and you're paying attention to that thought, and that's the object of your mind at that time, right? Which, okay, fair enough. But that's not what dhammas mean in that context, because dhamma also includes everything which is happening in your mind, including things which you're not paying attention to at all, and things that you might not even be conscious of. So, for example, you might be having a thought, and while you're having the thought, you're also getting angry about that thought. You might not be aware that you're getting angry about it, right? You might not notice that, but the anger's coming up, and it's only later you might become aware of it. There might be perceptions, there might be memories, there might be all kinds of things which are happening in your mind that you're not actually paying attention to. They're not an object of your mind, and yet they're still there as part of the Dhamma, as part of what's happening. So if we are to translate Dhammas in that context, I've translated something like mental phenomena. Okay, so it's like everything which is going in your mind, including those things that you're paying attention to and focusing on, but also just everything that's happening in your mind. So mental phenomena, I think, works quite well there. However, in the context of Dhamma-nupassana, it doesn't mean mental phenomena. Dhamma in this context means principles. Specifically, it means principles of causality. Okay? Cause and effect. Why do things happen? Why are things working in this way? How do they work? That's what I'm trying to get at by using the translation of principles. Dhamma, of course, means different things in different contexts, so we can't translate it consistently, but in many cases this is what the word Dhamma means. It's pointed to cause and effect, natural principles. Yes?
So what's the difference between aspect of mind and aspect of principles? So we're talking about thought,
and so the principles is understanding cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Right? So you can be aware of what's going on in your mind without understanding cause and effect, right? You might know, oh, I'm feeling angry. You're aware of that anger. You know what it feels like. You're very clearly aware of that, right? But you don't understand that anger yet, okay? Where does it come from? Why is it that I get angry when I think about this? I don't get angry when I think about that, yeah? What are the roots of that? Yeah? So this is where the aspect of the principles come through, and that's what we'll see more clearly when we have a look at the practice in detail. But that's the basic idea.